How's everyone doing? Alright. Some new faces and some old faces. Old new faces. Old young faces. How many of you are first timers here? Raise your hand. Two. Okay. I have quite a few tonight. Can people hear me in the back? No problem? Okay. I've been getting not necessarily complaints, but comments that the recordings online is volume is very low. That's because we have this small recorder and usually it's down here. So I bought one of these. Very helpful. So now I'm speaking right into it. So like, as usual, all of the talks will be available online. You can download and you can listen to again and again. Those of you who are first timers, how did you feel in the sitting? Good. Relaxing? How about a lot of thoughts? Or not so much?
It was hard to concentrate at all.
Mm-hmm. What kind of thoughts do you have?
Just things that I went through today.
Mm. The past.
Yeah. I have a lot of music playing.
A lot of music? And someone else?
I think about the future.
You think about the future? Different tasks you have to do?
Specifically a debate I have with the law professor on Friday.
Okay.
Some good ideas.
I'm planning. Okay. There's a very funny story. One time in China, there was a farmer. He heard that there was this Chan master in town, Zen master. So he wanted to study with him. So he was taught how to sit in meditation. And he has heard ideas of enlightenment, kind of spiritual awakening, and things of that sort. So he goes back home and practice every day and returned very shortly to his teacher. He said, "Master, I am enlightened." So the Zen master is like, "Oh, really? So what are you enlightened to?" And he said, "I had this sudden realization that my neighbor borrowed money from me about 20 years ago. And I totally forgot about it." So he just suddenly appeared. So for those of you new to meditation, that's one kind of enlightenment, enlightened to your past, right? Another type perhaps is enlightened to your future, the plans. So when the mind is quieted, usually we realize how much traffic is in our mind. All the things that repeat themselves, right? The expectations to the future, or memories of the past, and it's hard to turn them off. Right? And there's a lot of practices that teaches us how to turn it off. A lot of different spiritual paths. In general, the more complicated the method, visualization, thinking of this, contemplating that, the more complicated the method, the easier it is, because they busy ourselves with one topic. The difficult method are the simple ones, such as being aware of the breath, or putting the mind on one thing, When we want to put our mind on one thing, then he wants to stray away. So there are methods of repetition. Again, busying yourself, like a mantra, or some kind of sacred words that you repeat. That temporarily subdue all the chattering of the mind. Sometimes there are methods that are taught to visualize something pleasant, like a flower in the field. And through the visualization, you have a sensory experience of relaxed, clear. That also kind of temporarily quiets the mind. Sometimes there are methods that teach one to be familiar with an ideal. Right? Meditation on the expansiveness of the mind. Meditation on compassion, loving kindness. All of these are very good methods. But none of these are Chan methods. Chan methods does not teach one to pacify, quiet, or turn off the mind. This is a key distinction. The Chan approach teaches one to recognize the nature of mind. Then you won't be troubled by all the thoughts and chattering. So all of the teachings, like the teaching tonight, the text we will go to, essentially point to the nature of mind. I often give this analogy, since they're newcomers, probably never heard me say this, so I'll say it again. It's like nature of water is wetness, but there are all kinds of water, big waves, limpid, clear, or muddy water, but the nature does not change. Even in muddy water, the nature of wetness is always present. And it doesn't matter how muddy the water is. Right? Unless it's not water. But even if it's muddy or it's congealed, become a block of ice, right? Hard, stagnant, stubborn, right? And still wetness. So, big wave, turbid, right? And cause a lot of damage. Cool, refreshing, limpid, clear autumn pond, still silent, right? Transparent to the bottom, make us feel good when we look at them, right? An open expanse. Brings pleasure, perhaps, or a kind of serenity. But there's absolutely no difference from the perspective of the nature of water. So the key to Chan practice, and the key to understanding all the various teaching of Chan or Zen, is to understand that this teaching is really pointing to the true nature of our minds. Then one will be able to understand the text differently from a different perspective. So what happens if we understand the nature of mind? Then we are free from all the chaos, the damage, the good and the bad that seem to manipulate our equilibrium, our state. So the point is not actually wandering thoughts, scatterness, or whether we're able to sit very good without any wandering. Instead, in the midst of scattered thoughts, in the midst of maybe drowsiness, in the midst of when you're feeling so blissful, instead of attaching to them and identifying them as yourself, we let go the grasping hand and we see them for what they are. It's true nature of coming, rising, and passing away. Rising and passing away. Contingent on what? Contingent on the interactions of ourselves with the world. What does that mean? You bought a lottery ticket. Right? Someone holds a lottery ticket. You won interaction. And you become all happy. Right? So our happiness is contingent on interaction, what is perceived as good. But a person who's been perhaps, I don't know, maybe there's no such person, but maybe there is. A person who's can win the lottery time after time after time. He's just so bored of winning all the time. You know? The first time he won, maybe he's happy. You know? Second time, you know, elated. Third time, he's like, what the hell? why am I winning? The fourth time, he's like, damn. Fifth time, he doesn't even bother looking at the finding out whether he won or not. So happiness, sadness, depends on our perception. Similarly, our suffering, pain, depends on our perception. If someone were to force you to sit in meditation, and you don't want to, but because you came here just because your friend dragged you here, right? Then you'd be very painful. But then you struggle with that pain, and then when you hear, relax your body from top down to your feet, section by section, you say, okay, I'll just follow. And becoming aware of the sense of weight at the base. Sitting, relaxed, natural, and clear. And you find yourself all of a sudden in a very settled, stable state. Then your perception change. Even when you have leg pain, your experience will be different. Plus, when your mind is more stable, free from wandering thoughts, in that state, when you are experiencing physical discomfort, actually, the degree of pain will be drastically reduced. Drastically. Sometimes you're able even to sit through the pain because the mind is focused and clear. At the same time, when you reach that, the level of conceptuality actually reduces your conceptual mind. So you no longer experience it as pain, like a label, pain. Usually when people feel pain, they feel pain, this is pain. You label it as pain, and your whole body is in pain. But when you have no words, no concept, because the mind is very settled and clear, focused, then at that moment, it's just changing moment to moment experiences. Where's pain? It's just experiences. Of course, some of the experiences are like someone jabbing you with a knife, but it also changes. It turns from numbing to soreness to jabbing and then throbbing and then suddenly coolness. Do you know that the peak experience of pain, for example, someone stab a knife right into you, the peak experience of pain is actually coolness. You can try it. not stabbing yourself, of course, but sit through it. But if you identify as pain, label, words, and you dwell on it, then your whole body will tense up. But if you have no conceptual elaborations and attachments, it's just changing sensations. And you're able to localize it. It, instead of pain, my whole body, I'm having pain, and the whole body is burning up. It's just this area, maybe the ankle area. And it's just sensations. So the degree of suffering, discomfort, depends purely on perception. Doing something you don't want, someone forcing you to do it, it's going to be very painful. Doing something that you know is good, what you enjoy, it's very pleasant. Okay. So the key thing is our perception. Our perception. Now, most times, people are unable to free themselves from their perception. They identify experiences as themselves. Happy thoughts come, they become more happy. Sad thoughts come, they become very sorrowful. That means they cannot free themselves from this habitual mechanism of the process of your thought. This is attachment. Primarily, this is the kind of attachment that Buddhism, and particularly Chan Buddhism, seeks to be free from. It's not the sorrow itself. It's not the sadness. It's not the happiness. It's not the object, the feeling, the emotions. It's this identity. Right. That identity binds us, frees us, and formats us. If you always feel a certain way, for example, self-pity, low self-esteem, these kind of feelings and your identity with these feelings, attachment, will format you into a certain type of person. So that when you see the world, you tend to see it in this way only. Right? It's just like pain. Pain is no good. I don't want to sit here. You just tend to see it this way. But if you free yourself from these concepts, then you can see other dimensions of it. It's actually quite rich, the pain. Pain, rich. It's full of changing, very dynamic, changing sensations. Right. Pain, maybe not be a good example, but eating. The food that we enjoy. Right. Usually people eat a bunch of with a mind of scatteredness. So they can't really taste the food. But the mind is quieted, conversely, our experience becomes more exposed and more clarified. Right? Things are seen clear, sound are here, are heard clear, taste, maybe the taste of food. So that is a side product of slowly becoming free from the rigidity of one way of experiencing things or attachment. See? So because of this attachment, it's very difficult to see how things truly are, because you see it one-dimensionally, one way. Your way. And that's why Buddhism, Chan in particular, talks about no self. Just get yourself out of the equation. Then you actually see things. Yeah. Like less chattering, then more out there is perceived. Yeah. Less in here, you have to see things clear. You see? So, able to see things clear, you understand its true nature. So training in meditation or other aspects of practice, first of all, practice is not limited to meditation, right? Other aspects such as working, doing certain tasks, you know, calculating, doing homework, doing all kinds of things. When you are focused and clear, and learning to be free from rigidity and attachment, that's practice. That's chan practice. So in that sense, it's very different than practice as a kind of cutting off thought, so you're in a state of stasis. Turning off the mind, or temporarily suppressing something, or kind of zapping into a blissful state. Nothing to do with that from the Chan perspective. Chan perspective is to see the true nature of things as they are, without the filtration of this perpetual sense of self-referentiality. Filtering everything, your judgment, your experience, your opinion, everything to this through your own eye. Get yourself out of it. Nor is it being objective. I mentioned this last week after the sitting. So it's not subjective, right? Definitely, right? See things, interpret things your own way. Nor is it objective, right? Objective sounds like it's kind of Zen way, seeing things as they are, but objective is just a collection of subject views, consensus, opinion of everything. That's not. If that is enlightenment, it would be very easy to become enlightened. Just be objective, right? So it's not subjective. It's not objective. It's. Can I think of a word that's not subjective and objective? It's just free yourself. Free yourself from any views, objective view and subjective view. Like a mirror, the mirror doesn't have any particular views. If a mirror has a view, then it's like a permanent image kind of etched on the mirror. And everything that comes in front of it is always juxtaposed. You can't really see what it is. So, no views, it just reflects. So this is a brief orientation to Chan before we get to the text. The reason this text is chosen is because, well, first of all, I wanted to choose an early text. This is the earliest as you can get. This text is attributed to Bodhidharma, the supposed alleged founder of the Chan tradition. He was an Indian monk who came to China, 6th century, let's say. And instead of bringing a whole stack of scriptures to translate, this was a period when Buddhism was being introduced to China. So usually missionaries, they bring a whole bunch of texts, right? And Buddhism has thousands of them, right? So instead of bringing all these texts, it just kind of just came, right? He is the text. Scripture, right here. So gave teachings. And when the emperor found out this great monk is coming, invited him to the court. Says, you know, I've been giving patronage to Buddhism, building temples, ordaining monks, holding ceremonies to ordain monks. How much merit do I have? Religious merit. Usually people are very respectful and subservient to the emperor. First of all, the monk, he didn't wear any shoes. So he was already kind of in appearance. The Chinese, he doesn't wear, he's barefooted. And he's hairy. He's full of beard. Right? It's just a sash, a robe. So it's just straightforward way, like Chan. Not subjective, not objective, just straightforward. Says no merit. You don't say that to the emperor. Usually you get a head chop off if you don't agree with the emperor. Says no merit. He said no merit. Who the hell do you think you are? Of course I'm paraphrasing, translating in modern way. What he said was, who is it that stand before me? It's like, how dare you? Who are you? He says, don't know. Mm-hmm. Now the emperor is just baffled. Supposed to be a great Indian monk. You know, we were sent message that an Indian monk, great monk is going to come. I receive you. I want to share with you what I have done to our nation, patronizing Buddhism. You say, I have no merit, and you don't even know who you are. Bodhidharma sensed that time is not ripe. So he left. First of all, it was a miracle that he was allowed to leave. The emperor just, okay. And then he later conveyed this dialogue, this exchange, to his advisor. One of his advisors was a very learned Buddhist monk. Upon hearing this, he says, no merit. And he just joined his palms. Says, he's giving you the true teaching. Says, what? True teachings? Says, if you think there's an I, they gain something out there, subject, object, then surely you have destroyed all of your religious merit. That's how we operate. It's me, mine, you, other out there. This separate, independent, and most often the way we operate, permanent. Chan in Buddhism says these three separate, independent, permanent are only assumptions. Sense of I are only assumptions. But this assumption is so deeply ingrained that we're kind of wired into thinking things this way. But how things actually are, the true nature of who we are, the true nature of everything, is that it's not separate, but it's connected. It's not independent, but interdependent. It's not permanent, but it's impermanent. That's the true nature. Guogu is made up of non-guogu. All my thoughts, my opinion, my experiences come from the interaction with everything. My own views, it's just a collection of other views. Right? So the view is another problem. It's back to what I was saying before, the identity. Operating, living out our lives on the basis of this ingrained assumption, this identity, this attachment, then becomes a problem. Because if there's my merit, then there's your merit. Then there's competition. I want to be more meritorious. Right? And when you impinge on my merit, that's mine, right? Then there's problems. Just like when a nation has a vested interest in another nation's resources. When another nation wants to come, then there's conflict. So when there's subject, object, there's clash. See? So, that's not how things actually are. How things actually are is the way we live our lives is intimately connected with everything else. So this insight into this wisdom of how things actually are, this interdependence, connectedness, not separable, inseparable reality, that's our true nature. That is called emptiness. And Bodhidharma's reply, no merit, that no is, in Chinese, is wu. In Japanese is mu, and that is the translation of emptiness. So it's a kind of playing with words, right? How much merit do I have? Empty. Is it like really nothing? No, in emptiness there's fullness. Everything's connected. The mere fact that one person is able to exercise merit, create merit, is because of the merit of everyone else. Right. The emperor's officials, magistrates, workers, and everything. The people that receive the merit, everything. So emptiness. The first teaching was emptiness. Interconnected. Inseparable and impermanent, constant change. Second teaching, when the emperor told about, well, okay, now I understand, but what about when I asked him who he is? He said he don't even know. His reply is not, I don't know. He just says, don't know. There's no someone who knows or something to be known. Just one knife, sword, slash right through the opposition of subject, object. Knower, the known. Don't know. If he said, oh, I'm Bodhidharma, you know, the message that you got, the famous Indian monk? Yeah, me. Imagine if he said that. He said, oh, you. Prostrate to you. Don't know. Right. If you know, then you know, I know you. Like all of us, we think we know. We think we know ourselves. We think we know someone else. Even someone that's done something to you long time ago that's not so pleasant, you still remember. I know he is or she is bad. The assumption is bad to me. So this rigidity is the way we're wired. It's so ingrained. Because, but when this is there, right, you can't really see the person out there, let alone see yourself, your own true nature. Second teacher, second teaching, Bodhidharma's second teaching, whew, went right by, right? And then someone had to explain, like what I'm doing, explain verbally, conceptually, the meaning. But too much explanation, too much conceptuality, just adds more stuff, kind of clutter. Adds more clutter to the existing concepts and ideas that we have. But it's necessary in this occasion. It's a Dharma talk, so I'm supposed to talk. If I just sat there like, pass it around. Then it wouldn't be too fun. You're like, what? Whew. Like right there. Please pass it around. So with this understanding, we'll go into the text. Later on, Bodhidharma eventually was able to find successors, people that really understood his teaching. And from then on, he only had four students. Just four. Usually Dharma centers and teachers, they want a lot of students, right? Chan is quality, not quantity. Right. Although sometimes quality is good too. Mm-hmm. I may not have enough. If you you can share. Okay. So from four students, the whole Chan lineage continued up to today. Now it's spread to the West. So this is a text there are several translations. It's a short text. The first series of my talks was on the Heart Sutra, basic Mahayana teachings. Now, which is online, you can download and listen. Now, I'm choosing this very early Chan text. I translated based on some existing translations. I will read it. This text is called Two Entrances, sometimes Entries, and Four Practices. Let's see what these entries are and practices are. Now, in entering the path, there are many ways. In summary, there are two. The first is entrance by principle. The second entrance by practice. I have to edit this text. It's not that. It's an incomplete sentence. The text continues. Entering by principle means that one awakens to the essence by means of the teachings. And one deeply believes that all beings share the same true nature. It is only due to the covering of adventitious dust that deluded thinking that the true nature is not revealed. If one relinquishes delusion and returns to the real, abiding in concentration and engaging wargazing, this translation wargazing should be abiding in concentration and engaging in warlike contemplation. Warlike contemplation. That would be a better translation.
What does adventitious
mean? Extra.
Extra?
Extra. Let's continue. Abiding in concentration and in warlike contemplation, where self and other are absent, and the ordinary and holy are equal. Then without wavering whatsoever, and not chasing after written teachings, one is in sublime accordance with this principle. This is a state free from discrimination, in utter quiescence and without any effort. This is called entrance by principle. Entering by practice refers to four practices. All other practices are subsumed under these. What are the four? The first is the practice of embracing retribution. The second is the practice of adapting to conditions. The third is the practice of non-seeking. And the fourth is the practice of according with the Dharma. Embracing retribution means when a practitioner of the path encounters suffering, he thinks to himself or herself, for innumerable eons, I have forsaken the root, that is, the truth, and turned toward branches and wandering through various existences, giving rise to countless instances of ill will and hatred against others. Though today I do no wrong, I'm reaping the fruit of my past actions. Neither gods nor people can foresee when will be the ripening of the karmic fruit. I accept this with open heart, without ill will or complaint. The sutra says, when you meet suffering, do not be upset, because you're able to comprehend its underlying cause. When you're able to give rise to this thought, you are in accordance with the principle. Experiencing karmic retribution as an opportunity to advance on the path, this is called the practice of embracing retribution. The second is the practice of adapting to conditions. Sentient beings are without autonomy and are whirled around by the conditions of their karmic actions. Their suffering and joy are all experienced through the rising and perishing of conditions. Favorable rewards, such as honor and fortune, are results of causes from one's past lives. Even though I'm experiencing these karmic rewards, when the conditions change, they will cease to exist. What is there to be joyful about? Gaining and losing stem from conditions. But mind does not increase or decrease. Unmoved by the winds of joy, one is mysteriously in accordance with the path. Therefore, it is called the practice of adapting to conditions. The third is the practice of non-seeking. People of this world are always confused, coveting after this or that. This is what is meant by seeking. The wise awakens to the truth. They adhere to the principle and reverse that which is considered conventional. They pacify their own minds and act effortlessly. They flow along in the turning of samsara, the ocean of suffering. Yet understands that the 10,000 existences, rebirths, that is, are empty. Wishing for nothing and delighting in neither merit nor darkness. To dwell in the three realms is to dwell in the burning house. To have a body is to suffer. Is there anyone with a physical body who knows peace? If one understands this, then attachment to existence will be relinquished. False concepts will cease, and desires will be quenched. The sutra says, to seek is to suffer. To seek nothing is bliss. To discern that non-seeking is truly the path. Therefore, it is called the practice of non-seeking. I really have to edit this. Just like translate it quickly before the first talk, like half an hour before. Maybe one of you can help edit this. Thank you. The fourth is the practice of according with the Dharma. Dharma here means to perceive the principle that our nature is intrinsically pure. By this principle, all characteristics are empty, without defilement, without attachment, without this and that. The sutra says, Dharma is without sentient beings because it is free from the impurities of sentient beings. The Dharma is also without self, since it is free from the impurity of self, or the stains. Impurities here is like stains. If a wise person is able to believing and understand this principle, he or she should practice according to Dharma. The substance of Dharma is not miserly. Thus the wise can give up his life, wealth, and practice giving, because his mind is free from miserliness. He will comprehend the three emptinesses of self, other, and the object. Solicit nothing and not be attached. For the sake of eliminating impurities, they deliver sentient beings without clinging to characteristics or appearances. This is the practice of benefiting oneself and others, which also adorns the path of Bodhi, awakening, that is. When you give in this spirit, the other five perfections follow suit. He's referring to the six perfections, six paramitas, which we'll get to when we talk about this passage. Continuing, in order to eliminate delusion, one practices the six perfections, and yet there's nothing that is practiced. This is the practice of according with the Dharma. I want to focus on the first section, which is entering the path through principle. Basically, there are two ways entering the path: through principle or through practice, right? And how Bodhidharma describes the principle is four essential ingredients. Let's look at the text. First, one awakens to the essence. You can understand essence as reality, the truth of things, how things actually are, and also the essence of this teaching, the Chan teachings, right? By means of the teachings. Here, teaching means doctrine, right? So you enter experientially the path by means of the teachings. This means the teachings is really like fingers pointing at the moon. They themselves are not like the ultimate word. Many people, before they practice, they read a lot of Buddhist texts, like philosophy. They can debate about it. And to a certain extent, their views developed from reading has replaced their earlier understandings of things. For example, before they practice, they read Buddhism about everything is interconnected, is impermanent, interdependent. It's useful because next time that person has vexations, someone yells at that person. You say, okay, everything is interdependent. It's impermanent. It's like voice coming this way. You idiot. Coming here. And then idiot. Oh, sounds impermanent. So the teaching is useful to some extent. But when a person, instead of using the teachings to gain experience, to be free from vexations, so it's impermanent, I hear it, oh, everything's related, interdependent. Maybe I did something to him, or maybe something else happened to him. He woke up on one side of the bed. Right? Things happen because of different reasons coming together. Things also disappear because of different reasons coming together, interdependent. Right? So using that teachings to free yourself from potential vexations, right? That's good. But some people, they read a lot, they think a lot, and they start to attach to the teaching as some kind of ultimate truth. And that's the problem. Then the teaching becomes just another thing for them to attach to. Before, they're into something else. Now they're into the Dharma. And the Dharma says things are empty, impermanent. At one time, I had a Dharma brother. This is when I was a monk in the monastery. My Dharma brother was practicing really hard, meditating every day on his free time. Right? And when he saw everyone not practicing, like talking, chatting. I mean, monks' life, we may think, have a romantic view that monks live their life kind of solemnly, you know, always practicing. No. We banter around, kind of chase each other, you know, criticize each other, right? And joke, sort of free time. We're all joking around. He comes along, you should be practicing. You know. Don't you know that, you know, went on and on and on about Dharma is empty, you know, everything is permanent, and we should take precious of our time. And we all looked at him like this. Yeah, anyway, I was talking about that, you know, blah, blah, blah. So he was like, went back to meditation, you know. This reminds me of a story. And the point of that story is really, when we think something is right, something is true, then we see everyone else is false. Same thing with practice. When you practice very hard, then you see those people that you think is not practicing. Already you have an idea what practice is. Practice is not joking around. Right, talking, that's not practice. What's practice? His meditation. You know? When you have a fixed idea of what practice, then just that's just like spiritual materialism. You've substituted, before you become a monk, you're into kind of nice watches, nice clothing. Now you're practicing, you're into Dharma and impermanence, and it becomes poison. Therefore, Bodhidharma says what he did. Right? One awakens to the essence by means of teachings. Not that teaching is expedient. That's why Shakyamuni Buddha, at the end of his life, the historical Buddha, said that, "I've taught for 40 years, wandering throughout the land, right, the Indian subcontinent." He said, "I have not given a single teaching." Said, "What? But you did. I memorized them all." You know. This also reminds me of Master Ling Ji, one of the greatest masters in the Chan tradition. A whole school was developed from him. The Rinzai, the Ling Ji school of Chan Zen. When he became enlightened. Well, his enlightenment is very, very interesting. He practiced very hard. He studied everything. Actually, he studied the Buddhist behavioral codes. He was a Vinaya master. He knows perfectly the Buddhist rules and regulations. The perfect monk. No problem. You have a question, he can answer. You have a problem, he can solve. Too perfect. Then the head monk says, "Why don't you go see the Chan master? No, I have no questions." Don't worry about it. Just make up a question. Go ask him. Like, ask him, what is the meaning of Buddha Dharma? What is the meaning of Dharma? But I know that. Don't worry. Just go ask him. So he goes into the room, bowed. "Master, I have a question." "Shoot." This is my other translation. And, just, "What is the meaning of the Dharma? The true meaning of Dharma? True essence." Right. And the master picked up his stick and whack! And he's like, "This crazy old man, what is he doing?" "Get out." As soon as he get out, the head monk knew it all along. He's gonna get there. It's like, "So what happened?" "He hit me." "Don't worry, just go back. Go back. Yeah, go back. Trust me. You have to be asked more sincerely." Goes back. The second day. Knock. "Master, what is the meaning?" Bam! He didn't even finish the sentence the second time. It's like, ran back, ran away. This guy's crazy. You know? That's not a true teaching. The monk's waiting outside. "So, what happened?" "I didn't even finish my sentence. My question, he hit me. There's something. Am I doing something wrong? There's something wrong with me. Was it something I said? Was it my behavior? I study Buddhist behavioral codes. I'm perfect." All the things going through his head. What is wrong? Why is it hit me? What did I do wrong? Why? 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 He says, "Why? What did I do?" He says, "That's a very good question. Should we dwell on that? But go back." Next day, he was ready to go back. And the head monk says to the master, "You know, Ling Ji, Yi Xuan, his name is Yi Xuan. Ling Ji, Yi Xuan. Yi Xuan is going to come to you today. Take it easy on him, please." I don't think he fully understands. But he's almost there. Almost there. Meanwhile, throughout the night, the discourse record doesn't say what happens. They just tell you the story, like third day he went back. But you can imagine, this is your teacher. You have questions, irresolvable questions. And you, what's wrong with me? Why is it? Why did he hit me? Did I do something wrong? All night he couldn't sleep. This is my kind of inserts, footnotes. He goes back. He opens the door. This time he stands a little bit distant from the master. He just joins his palm. He didn't say anything. Because he knows what's going to happen, perhaps. But the master saw in him something that was precious. The sincerity, earnestness. Yet, he was shaken up. And that's precisely, from the Chan perspective, a good place to be. This irresolvable question. And then he says, okay, you go to my Dharma friend, Dharma teacher friend. It's at the other side of the mountain. You go see him. He will solve this. He did not answer. Imagine if he says, oh, you know Buddha Dharma? Oh, let me tell you exactly what Buddha Dharma is. You know, Four Noble Truths. You know, you gotta uphold precept, you gotta meditate, and in meditation you gotta relax, natural and clear. Right? If he has did that, he would have just dissolved all the momentum of the practice. That's what Chan masters are great at doing. You have no problem, they create problems. When you have a problem, when you have a doubt, you want to know, you want to resolve this issue, then in Chan we say small doubt, small enlightenment. Medium doubt, medium enlightenment. Big doubt, big enlightenment. No doubt, no enlightenment. Right? He was perfect, he had no problem. So, problem. You have no problem? Give you some problem. When he went to see the master at the other side of the mountain, we can just imagine what he went through. There's no car, vehicle. He just walked through the mountain by himself, sojourning to one mountainside to the other. We can imagine the process, like the way we do, walking meditation, focused on this irresolvable question. What did I do wrong? What is the meaning? I must be doing something wrong. Because I didn't understand the Buddha Dharma. What? I thought I did. What? As soon as he reached the other Zen master, he saw him. Something is different about this guy. He's not like the other monks that are just eating rice and meditating. Where do you come from? I come from Huangbo, his master. Ah, Huangbo, what is that old man up to these days? And we can tell by his reply that that was on his mind, because that was imminently upfront, irresolvable question. The first way he came out is, I asked him three times, what's the meaning of Buddha Dharma? And he hit me. That was on his mind. So we know what he went through, sojourning from one mountainside to the next, months. And then he said, here's the opportunity. Chan masters are great at doing this. You have no problem, they create problem, and then they solve it. Like a sword of wisdom cutting right through your attachment. Right? But you have to generate that momentum. Right? So, he says, is that what the old man's up to? Such a generous teacher, like your grandma taking care of the kids. You know our grandmas, you know our grandma, your mother, your father don't give you spending money. You go, hey grandma, I need to buy this. Grandmas are softies, right? Grandpas. Okay. Here's some money. So he's saying that Huangbo is too kind to him, exposing the teaching right in front of his face, and yet he didn't get it. As soon as he heard that, thorough enlightenment. Huangbo is so kind to you, like an old grandmother. He's giving you the teaching, just like Bodhidharma. Did I gain merit? No. Who are you? Don't know. Cutting off any conceptualization, any attachment. Right? What is the Buddha Dharma? Like there's some ultimate thing called Dharma out there. Whack! Right? Second time. So to generate that momentum, the point is not really there's no Dharma. Imagine if Huangpo says to him conceptually, elaboration, explanation, oh, you know, the true teaching is no teaching. You know, don't attach to this and that. And he says, oh, thank you, I got it. That would have been just all over, dead. The whole point of teaching was just dissolved. Right? You need that echo into reverberation, echoing. What is the Dharma? What is the Dharma? I don't know. Don't know. Don't know. Don't know. Did I do something wrong? What is wrong? And then someone comes along. He exposed it right in front of you. And then he became so happy, he started beating the hell out of the Chan Master. He's like, and then the Master's like, I'm not your teacher. Go ahead, Huangpo. And he went back. As soon as Huangpo see him, something has changed in this monk, because he's thoroughly enlightened. His bones, his feature, his whole air about him is completely changed. He says, as soon as he come back, he says, what happened? What did you learn? What happened at Da Yu Shan? His fellow Dharma teacher friend, he says, this happened. Bam! Right to the gut. And Huangpo is like, this little cub is trying to pull the whiskers of the tiger. He didn't say, ouch, you damn fool. He says, this little cub, we are the same nature. We have the same species now. You and I have tasted the Dharma. But too rough. Try to pull the whiskers, right? Playing with me. He says, from then on, Lin Ji, everyone was meditating. He just kind of sat down across the meditation bench. And one time, no one said anything. The head monk knows what happened. The head monk is enlightened too. So, see that? Goes on. One time Huangpo came and checked himself. Sees Lin Ji sitting there, snoring, lying down. And this monk next to him, meditating, perfect posture, still. He took the board and whacked him. He says, don't you see Lin Ji? How hard he's practicing? What the hell are you doing? So, the point of the story is practice, not practice. What we think of practice is, don't think there's a fixed form. Right? Like my friend thinks, joking around with people is not practice. Meditation is practice. The second aspect, dimension to this, entering from the principle. One deeply believes that all beings share this true nature, the same true nature. What is this nature? If I were to use concept, words, language, that's what I was talking about before. Empty nature. Emptiness means connectedness. The problem is we don't believe it. We're so wired up into thinking our own learned, acquired views are correct that we can't see how things actually are. Third dimension. It is only due to the covering of this adventitious dust. Dust here has a connotation of something extra, like a mirror, the dust that covers the mirror. Even though it's covered, the mirror still has the ability to reflect, to be luminous, but temporarily covered up. By what? Deluded thinking. What kind of thinking is deluded thinking? Thinking of things as permanent, separate, independent. Our own false assumptions of how things actually operate. It's only because of this that a true nature is not revealed. If one relinquishes delusion, returns to the real, and engaging what he calls this warlike contemplation, where self and others are absent, subject, object, gone. Ordinary, holy are equal. Why is ordinary and holy equal? Big wave of tsunami and a limpid pool. So peaceful there. One is dangerous, one is peaceful. Same nature. When you sit there with a lot of wandering thoughts and you don't like it, the next time you practice, the more you practice, you become more skilled, of course, and you can get into that nice, comfortable zone of bliss. You think that's good. They're of same equal nature. But because of our deluded thinking, that's good, this is bad, our compartmentalizing, categorizing our experience into good and bad, based on what? Of course, me. I think it's good, I think that's bad. Operating that way, we fail to see what's actually happening, the true nature. So, for this reason, a teacher in the Chan tradition sees everyone equally. He or she sees your Buddha nature. It doesn't matter if a person is a criminal or a person is a sage or a very devout student. The same. Equanimity. That is compassion. How? Because it's intimately related to the understanding of emptiness. It's not compassion because, oh, the teacher is just kind to everyone, let everyone step over him. No. He sees your empty nature. Emptiness. Everything is interconnected. Inseparable. Therefore, the wisdom of emptiness and compassion in Buddhism and Chan is the same thing. So, smashing, giving a big blow to your teacher, only if you're enlightened, is compassion, is your demonstration of wisdom. Right. Drinking water, right. Lifting a piece of paper, if you're in a state of enlightenment, that's compassion. Why? Because it's no longer self-referential. You don't operate based on self-referential. You don't operate based on objectively the consensus of everyone either. The consensus of everyone is just like this matrix that everyone have collectively constructed. Right? So the enlightened person is unplugged from this matrix. Like Neo. So, neither subjective or objective, just as they are. That is the true meaning of warlike contemplation. Some people think that contemplate the war is like sitting facing the wall like we do, right? Becoming stagnant, still, not moving. No. Walls are quite functional. A lot of purposes. Look all the beautiful paintings that we have hung there. Right? There are functions to wall. Right? Very useful. The reasons why a person engaging this is not swayed by self and others, holy and ordinary, is because, do the world judge what kind of painting you put on? I said, no. I don't want the ugly painting. I want a beautiful painting. No. You can hang all kinds of stuff to the wall. The wall has no judgments. Its function is just to be. Its usefulness depends on everyone else. Like a mirror. So, we'll continue next time. Any questions? Yeah, I can always count on Linda for questions. Yes.
I was very timidly indicating before, but I figured you'd call on me when you were ready. You know, on the subject of pain, back in the beginning.
Okay.
You talked about not interpreting it as pain, but interpreting it in different ways, like coolness or throbbing.
Yes. The point of what I said was experience it without all these labels and words we try. Then you will not solidify this thing as pain. Once you do that, the body becomes tense and we just become subjected to it. But to allow it to be open. And those adjectives are basically words, descriptions of all kinds of possibilities that could be experienced when we stop labeling. That was the point. So similarly, if you stop labeling this as pain and identify as bad, bliss, identify that as good. Of course, good and bad based on your self-preference, self-opinion. If we stop doing that, then we will be able to see more perspectives, open to more possibilities, and experience more things. And they could be throbbing, could be, you know, changing, jabbing kind of pain, it could be this, it could be that, but it could be all kinds of things, infinitely.
Right. You know, in the United States, they interpret for childbirth, they don't call it pain, they call it contractions.
Contractions. Yeah. 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 Some people, by the way, part of chan practice, your threshold of pain will be higher the longer you practice. Some people just have a higher threshold, you know. Some people a little bit of pain, they can't stand it. Right. Different. Yes.
In getting rid of judgments and object, you know,
yes.
That themselves seem to have, you know, self and an object. And I'm not understanding the degree to which you want to let that go. I mean, you still have to have some sort of moral code, ethical code.
Yes.
Of conduct.
Yes. For Chan, this is speaking from the perspective of the nature. It's like speaking from the perspective of the nature of water. It's not speaking from the perspective of the function of water, which can quench thirst or it can do damage, right? Or infinite ways its function. So we have to always distinguish what perspective is this talking about. Right? Because if we read on, we will understand that if one is in accordance with the Dharma, then one will be free. Right? And one will practice truly the six perfections. Surely those are moral values, codes. The six perfections, first one, generosity, giving. Right? Very foundation. Second, precepts. rules and regulations, right? And then zeal, you know, diligence, concentration, you know, patience, wisdom, so on. So all those things should be practiced. And he left at the end of the text, right? We should practice it. But in the midst of practicing it, we're not subjected to it, to allow it to become some kind of a new set of things that we attach to, substituting our old things, and then use that to judge people, right? Like a measure, like a ruler. You're not practicing. Hey, you're supposed to be a bodhisattva, practice the six perfections. Now, give me that. Practice giving or something, you know? Yeah. Right? So we don't use it that anymore. Yes?
It's kind of like, you know, when you walk out of here, you just feel good. You know, you just have this mental clarity, and it kind of makes you want to do those good things all the
mm-hmm.
time, and just
yeah.
be and live
yeah.
your life and
yeah.
not let things affect you.
Mm-hmm. I would say yes, but a step further would be not even let the good things affect us. Right? The negativities is the good things that's very hard. Like sitting here, you know, I'm so compassionate. Yeah, let me help you. This self-identity, even let that go. So when someone asks you, "Who are you?" Don't know. Yes. Yeah, so you have to begin with attachment.
Yeah.
You begin with it. So the Buddhist teaching of emptiness and no self is founded on self, a healthy self, right? A kind of self that's stable mentally, and then practice, and then slowly the self matures, and then you give the highest teaching, the Chan teaching, like that perfect monk. If a person is already not upholding precepts, kind of escaping, jumping the A-walling the monk, the monastery to drink beer and stuff like that. Some monks do that, by the way. You know, it's already doing that. You don't give them teaching of emptiness. You give them teaching like, precepts, please. Yeah. Very basic. Yeah. So start with yourself, knowing what's good, what's not good, what's valuable, and have an open mind. Don't attach to the good, don't attach to the valuable. Just understand this is conventionally how things work. And then, slowly, work that way. Anything, anyone else? Yes.
It's like, my understanding of this is that there's like, you can enter the path through either like an understanding or by doing.
Yeah. Yes. That's why the Chan path is often understood as the path of recognition, as opposed to the path of purification. The Buddhist path, sometimes people divide it into two ways. The path of kind of gradual, slowly purifying oneself, transforming oneself from A to B. That's one way of understanding the Buddhist practice. Another way is understanding as very different from this. It's the path of recognition. What do you transform from A to B? The true nature is the same. You see? Yes, in the course of practice, big wave of water, we want to be able to calm down, because if it's not calm, we can't even possibly see the nature of clarity that is water, right? If it's muddy. So you want to kind of do that too, right? But once you get to a certain stage, you don't become stagnant, stay in that kind of, you have to transform to the path of recognition. Recognizing. And that is Chan. So Chan teaching, Zen teachings, is not separate from Buddhism. It's built on top of Buddhism, like a pyramid. It's the top teaching. So wrongly used, a person can be just do whatever they want. Everything's empty, you know. So you have to be careful. So it's, and this text is careful. Does it say no need to practice paramita, perfections? No, it didn't say that. The practices is talking about recognizing karma, and his retribution, and so on and so forth. So thank you for your question. That will be the last question, because we're already over time. And those of you who are first timers who wish to sign up on the mailing list for upcoming activities, there will be a piece of paper. You can print your name clearly. It can be added. One activity coming up is 16th. Is that a Saturday? 13th? 13th. There's a from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. a full meditation workshop talking about stages of practice, signposts in practice, different realizations, different pitfalls, different illusions that arise from meditation. Right? Physiological posture, mental posture in practice, different methods. So a very complete class. And it's free. Everything is based on donation. So you can sign up for that. Not yet. An email will be sent out and you can for you to register. So you can sign up on the mailing list. For those of you who like to give donations, our donation box was raided, by the way. So that tea ceremony, several hundreds of dollars. Right? And the half-day retreat is just gone. Right? So now we're going to change a donation box. So we're going to use another one. Because that donation box is by a kind of like the padlock, which is held by screws. So all you have to need is to take the screws out, and the whole top opens. Just take it out. So remember one time when, on the way out, some of you who leaves later, the door knob was kind of off. Remember? I think someone has been kind of coming regularly. Right. So they took the box was loose too. Yeah. Yeah. So, but like Bodhidharma says, encountering karmic retribution, we must, we'll leave that section for next time, recognizing it, and see it as opportunity to practice. Yeah. All right. So, if you want to donate, just put it in a basket, so we have to collect the money and then give it to the board. Okay, I'll take it out.
Okay.
Actually, the top you can just.
Oh, is it open?
Yeah, it's
okay,
it's open.
I'll take it out.
Okay. Thank you. Oh, this goes to the back. That show.
Thank you.
Thank you.